from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. A deal is in place to pull the nation back from the so-called fiscal cliff. Last night, the House passed a bill to prevent automatic federal spending cuts and tax increases. In this hour, we'll explain what was in the compromise bill and what it could mean for California's recovering economy. We'll consider whether this sets up more political battles over how America spends its money. And we'll get insights on what the painful sausage-making behind the fiscal cliff deal teaches us about the art of negotiation. There's a lot to cover, and we welcome your questions and thoughts as America steps back from the fiscal cliff. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, filling in for Michael Krasny. It was an 11th-hour debate that lasted way past the 11th hour, but a deal is finally in place regarding America's so-called fiscal cliff. The House passed a bill last night just after 11 p.m. Eastern Time. President Obama says he will sign it into law. The compromise package addresses some issues, postpones others, and spares the nation from what some speculated would be another recession. Let's begin this hour of Forum by explaining what is in the deal, how it came about, and what it means for you and me. Then we'll get some expert insight from UCLA on how California's economy looks in the next few years and how the fiscal cliff deal affects that. Later on, a Harvard expert on negotiation will dissect the congressional cage match for insights on how deals do and don't get done. There's a lot to discuss, and we'll open the phones in a moment for your questions and thoughts. But first, let's get the latest from David Wessel. He's the economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. Mr. Wessel, welcome to Forum.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Glad that the cage match seems to be over at least for now, or perhaps only one round of it, and there are more rounds to come. Let's start with what happened last night. Break down the nuts and bolts of the deal as it was passed by the House.
Well, basically, after some pretty last-minute maneuvering among House Republicans, the House passed a bill that had already passed the Senate that essentially raises taxes in order to make a down payment on deficit reduction. It extends the Bush tax cuts for most Americans, but for those Americans who make over $400,000 or $450,000 a year, their income taxes will go up. For some people who make something less than that, their income taxes will go up. And for nearly all American workers, the ones who pay the payroll tax, a payroll tax holiday that was worth about $1,000 for every $50,000 of wages will disappear. So working people's taxes will go up. There's virtually no new spending cuts in this thing. It extends a lot of tax breaks that everybody knew was going to be extended otherwise. And it really doesn't go very far, maybe one-fifth of the way towards what needs to be done to reduce the deficit to sustainable levels.
One of the things that President Obama has said throughout this process is that he wanted to make sure that 98% of Americans, as he put it, 98% of Americans, the majority of working class America, did not feel a major tax pinch as a result of congressional inability to solve the problem of the fiscal cliff. How much did the president get what he was after, if at all?
Well, on income taxes, he got pretty much what he wanted. He said he wanted to raise income taxes on people who make over $250,000 a year. For many of them, their income taxes will go up one way or another. He was never quite clear on whether he wanted to extend the payroll tax cut for another year or two. That was always seen as a temporary measure during the recession. First he said he didn't want it, then his aide said he did want it, so he didn't get that. What he did not get, though, and this is important, is he didn't get some grand bargain that puts the deficit problem behind us. He just deferred the fight for another couple of months, and we're going to have another showdown over spending and over the debt ceiling before the end of March.
Yeah, I do want to get into that deferred fight in a minute, and we're going to discuss that not only with you but with our other guests through the hour. Let's focus on the day-to-day, what's in it for me piece from the beginning. I think that,
sure,
to me at least, is the most confusing
part.
What
it means to ordinary people is that when your paychecks come in 2013, you're going to see an increase in the payroll tax compared to last year, because 2 percentage points of your wages that was ordinarily taxed wasn't taxed under this anti-recession thing. As I said, if you make 50 grand a year, that means you're going to pay about $1,000 more in taxes. If you are an upper income earner, you're going to pay more income taxes, and that'll start to come out of your checks now. There were a whole lot of bad things that might have happened that have been taken care of. Various tax breaks that you would have noticed had they gone away, but they didn't go away. But the only real impact on people directly is that for many of them, their taxes go up more if you're at the upper end.
So this is something that some people will be feeling in their paychecks immediately, month to month, every 2 weeks.
Immediately might be a little strong because I think it'll take a while to get the withholding changes changed, but within weeks, yes.
Okay.
And the other thing to remember is that always you have to say compared to what. If for a lot of people, it's a lot less of a tax increase than we would have had to pay had Congress done nothing. And we've avoided probably the fear that if Congress screwed this up, we'd have a recession, which would, of course, show up in unemployment and all sorts of other things.
There are some liberals who have been accusing the president of caving in to Republicans by not boosting taxes on the rich more. And I guess that kind of goes to your whole compared to what point. I wonder how we view that in terms of whether the threshold had been the $250,000 versus $400,000. Is there a great big difference in terms of how that's going to affect the economy, or are we really talking a few minor percentage points here and there?
Well, I think that you're right, that some liberals wish that he had gotten more money out of taxes. There is a lot of money to be taxed between, say, $250,000 and $400,000 a year. And I think what some liberals are worried about is that if this is all we're going to get on taxes, then there's going to have to be even more spending cuts out of benefit programs in the next round of this thing. So they would have preferred more taxes because that would have meant less on spending cuts. There's also a pretty generous change to the estate tax, the tax that people pay when they die. It'll now affect people, only those who leave estates of more than $5 million, which is not very many people. And then the other thing the liberals are annoyed about is that the president didn't somehow get the Republicans to cave on raising the debt ceiling, because they know that when that comes up again, the Republicans will put a price on voting to do that.
That's another one of those things that was kind of kicked down the road a few months, right?
Correct.
We're speaking to David Wessel, the economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. We would love to speak to you, too. We know some of you have questions and thoughts about the whole fight over the fiscal cliff. Do give us a call, please. The number is 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. Hit us up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/kqedforum, or you can send us a tweet. We are at @kqedforum. David Wessel, there's also a number of other pieces to this whole package, and I don't want to get way into the weeds because there's so much. We could just get lost in the details forever. But there were also a number of other pieces that were designed to support the economy. For instance, business incentives. There were a great number of those that kind of weren't part of the top-line debate, but they're also going to have an impact too, right?
Right. I mean, a number of business tax breaks that had expired have been renewed as a result of this thing. And there is probably the most significant is that Congress a couple of years ago said they would give businesses a special tax break if they made more investment now as a way to get businesses to spend more during a weak economy. That has been renewed, although at a smaller amount. That will have some modest impact. But I think one thing that people are worried about is that this doesn't really do much to help the economy grow in the short run, and the economy is growing at a pretty frustratingly slow pace. There's not much in the way of, there was no infrastructure spending, which is something the president talked about, and there's none of the great advantage we were supposed to get by kind of settling a whole lot of issues and unleashing all this entrepreneurial energy that was supposed to come from doing away with uncertainty. I think on balance, people think this will probably be the equivalent of the government tapping the brakes a little on the economy at a time when it's already growing slowly.
David, let's go to the phones now. Let's take a quick call. Arthur in Palo Alto, good morning.
Good morning. I think we've already had some of the effects of the fiscal stimulus, cliff because of slow spending in the holiday season in most of the country. But I'm wondering what the prospects are for increasing the capital gains rate, as was done in the 1986 Reagan tax change, to match ordinary income taxes, except for investments in pre-IPO startups. Except for those investments, the investment in capital gain improving capital gains does not actually increase the economy. It just moves money between people.
All right, let's put that question to David Wessel. What do you think about Arthur's question about the capital gains tax?
The first thing we have to be clear on what has happened here. So the capital gains tax rate had been 15%. That's when you sell shares of stock. For most people, they had to pay taxes on 15% of the profits. It'll now go up to as much as 20%, depending on the taxpayer. So there is a slight increase there. But they did not do, as he suggested, bring the tax rates on wages and capital gains together, where they were after the 1986 tax reform thing. I think that there's always a possibility that they will revisit the tax code and do some big tax reform. And if they do that, I think this will be one of the issues on the table. Some people argue, as he does, that it's just a giveaway to investors. Other people say it's a necessary and welcome stimulus to people investing in startups and risking their capital and so forth. So there's a debate there, and there's been a long ongoing debate. I think my bottom line is that this process was so messy, the chances of doing some big tax reform that will change anything significant have been diminished significantly. So I think it's unlikely that that's going to happen, but I could be surprised.
You know, since you bring that up, I was just going to ask you about tax reform. And there are a lot of pieces of this that have just been really kicked for a few months. The sequestration cuts, those across-the-board cuts, half from defense and half from other programs, those have been kicked down the road for 2 months. What do we make of all this? I mean, it seems like we impose this fiscal cliff on ourselves as a nation legislatively to say we have to solve some of these problems by this date. And the way we've solved some of these problems is to set another date. Where do we look to this to finally get resolved? Or can we even say now?
Well, I don't think this was anybody's desired outcome for all the reasons you said. It doesn't deal with the problems with the tax code. It doesn't deal with the growth of healthcare spending. It doesn't put the nation's budget on a sustainable course. In order to avoid some terrible catastrophe to the economy, or what they thought would be a catastrophe, they basically put off these fights for a couple of months, as you said. Maybe the mood will be different at the end of February when they revisit this, and we'll be able to get some more long-term compromise that deals with the big fiscal issues. But at the moment, everybody seems to be so angry at each other that I think that the betting is that we'll have another showdown and it'll be another messy resolution. But it's really a little bit too early to tell that.
David, I know our time with you is limited. Let's go to another call before we have to let you go. Let's hear from John in Alameda. John, good morning.
Yeah, I was just reading online that there are a bunch of corporate giveaways in the bill, and I'd like to hear about some of that. For example, that the corporate funds can go stay offshore.
What happened here is that they basically took every corporate giveaway that's in the tax code that is expiring and extended it. There's a tax break for people who manufacture in American Samoa. There's something for people who make rum in Puerto Rico. There's stuff for people who invest in wind energy. All that talk about ending corporate welfare or reforming the tax code to get away from loopholes or dealing with the issue that the caller raised about encouraging incentives that may encourage businesses to invest overseas, they didn't fix anything. They just took what was there and said, leave it, and if it's expiring, we'll extend it for another year. That's what happens when you get gridlock. Whether that will be revisited is a really good question. I think there was some appetite among the business community and among Republicans and Democrats for thinking about changing the corporate tax code in far-reaching ways. But there are going to be a lot of winners and losers in that, and this whole process has made everybody kind of skittish of doing anything that is controversial.
Yeah, I hear you on that. David Wessel is the economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. David, I know your time is limited. We're going to let you go, but I really appreciate the insights on all the wrangling from last night. So thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Let's continue the conversation now with Jerry Nicholsberg, an adjunct professor of economics at UCLA's Anderson School of Management. He's also the senior economist for UCLA's Anderson Forecast, a quarterly economic analysis on the state, the nation, and the Los Angeles area. Professor Nicholsberg, hello.
Good morning.
We're also speaking now to Heidi Presbola, a congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. Heidi, welcome to Forum.
Thank you.
First of all, Heidi, did I pronounce your last name somewhat correct?
You Presbola? Did. You pronounced it very correctly.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Let me start with Professor Nicholsberg. I know that you recently, in the most recent Anderson forecast, wrote about California's economy, specifically as it relates to Proposition 30, this tax increase measure that Californians passed to try to save some very draconian budget cuts to education, particularly higher education and K-14 education. In light of that, of the fact that California is already rethinking its tax policy, and in light of the fiscal cliff deal, what do you expect for California's economy in the near term?
So for the first of all, I think it's important to realize that there's still a fiscal cliff there, that the spending cuts were just pushed down the road. There's still a lot of uncertainty going forward, and people are going to postpone decisions. What that means for California, particularly in light of Prop 30, is that we have a lot more uncertainty about the revenues that the state of California's government is going to receive. We're relying more heavily now than ever before on the income of the high-income earners. And so that's what Prop 30 was about, was raising taxes on the high-income earners. Well, the high-income earners don't earn salaries. They earn profits or IPO, capital gains, and the like. And those are going to be postponed or diminished right now, certainly in the coming months. So what we're seeing is California's economic growth is slowing. We saw that in the last couple of months. We expect that this year. And heretofore in the economic recovery, we've been growing faster than the U.S., but we really don't think that's going to continue, at least over the next 6 months.
You know, it had been pretty clear from what you wrote in the Anderson forecast and from what the Legislative Analyst's Office had written about Proposition 30 that we could be looking at a pretty good economy in 2014, if not 2013. Depends on a lot of things. There are a lot of different levers that pull in different directions. For instance, you elaborated in your report about higher income earning. You know, if you tax people a certain way, they'll spend differently. And if certain funds don't come in, then other funds have to move. It's all these different levers that pull against one another. Give me perhaps, because so much of this debate over the fiscal cliff has been incredibly negative, give me perhaps your best case scenario picture. How possibly might the continuing negotiations about the fiscal cliff and California's passage of Prop 30 work well? Is there a best case scenario that we can hope for?
Sure. The important thing in terms of the fiscal cliff is getting some certainty. And really where the negotiations ended up was that the Republicans said that we need fundamental tax reform and we need spending cuts. And the Democrats said, you know, we need the debt ceiling to be raised. So as we get 2 months down the road, those are going to go into some fairly serious negotiations. Well, supposing we come out of that with a reasonable long-term plan to reduce the deficit and to restore fiscal stability in Washington, and as well a reform of the tax system, then, you know, we have the adjustment to kind of the new reality, and that's 2013, the year we're in. And that's where we're expecting slow economic growth, because you take about a percent and a half out of economic growth with the higher taxes and the reduced spending. But that puts us on a more sound footing. It doesn't throw us into a recession. What that means for the state government is that we have time to reform both the revenue and expenditure side of the state budgetary process. If that were to take place, then I think the outlook for California is quite bright.
Let me bring in Heidi Presbola now, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. Heidi, talk to me about the last-minute 11th-hour negotiations that were going on behind the scenes. At first, we had the deal, and then GOP Congressman Eric Cantor said he didn't support it, and the House debate went on until late at night, and the vote just before midnight. Talk about how all that shook out in the last few hours.
knowing that this is just the way that Congress works and that
right.
they can't get anything done without a gun to their heads,
right.
We were all fully prepared for this. But in terms of the last-minute posturing, that's just what it was. You know, there were so many members in the Republican caucus who came out of that morning conference meeting, or actually stretching the afternoon conference meeting, who said, there's no way we could support this legislation. Is completely anathema to everything the Republican Party stands for on taxes and spending. So we've got to at least make an attempt, no matter how vain it is, and it just did wind up being vain, attempt to try and attach some spending cuts to this. At the end of the day, we knew that there was a handful of more than that, but there was a block of Republicans who were prepared and who have been prepared for weeks to cast this vote, but they had to look like they did everything they could to try and stop it. But, you know, based on my conversations I've been having for weeks with members off the floor, they knew that, you know, they were basically waving the white flag of surrender here for several weeks on taxes, and that they were going to have to support a bill that raised taxes in some portion. The bigger deal that they were hoping for would have also done some spending cuts, but the president made it clear that we gave you your spending cuts last year as part of the Budget Control Act, and now is the time to address the revenue component. So, you know, a number of these Republicans that did go ahead and cast that vote, they had different reasons for doing it. Either they were in safe districts and could do this, or they were in swing districts where there would be a lot of support for doing this. I happen to speak with a member, for example, from Arkansas, who had told me on background a couple of weeks ago, hey, look, you know, I can sustain the hit from the Tea Party mm-hmm. and cast this vote. What's more important is that we get this through versus having the entire party go up in flames because we're going to be responsible for going over the cliff.
So it sounds like what you're saying really is that this turned into a bit of political theater near the end, where people knew that this was going to happen, but they had to kind of put on their best game faces for the sake of their constituents and their seats.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was also, I have to say, a lot of anger coming out of these meetings. And I think that this does not bode well for going into the next cliff, because let's be frank, this has not by any means been settled. And the news today in Washington immediately pivots now to the debt ceiling. And, you know, I just got off the phone with a prominent Republican budget aide who said that, you know, tensions are extremely high up there, and there's very sore feelings over, you know, the way that this was all conducted, and with the president, for example, coming out before the ink was even dry on the deal, and many Republicans felt was kind of gloating about their concession.
Let me throw out a quick email. I know we're coming up on our first break in a moment. Sarah writes, the American public should demand that if Congress cannot reach an agreement to address the debt limit in the first quarter of 2013, then they should all be fired, i.e. not allowed to run for re-election. I imagine that some of them feel like their constituents are beginning to breathe down their necks just a little bit as a result of this whole fight.
Well, yes. I mean, this has been a problem with the public, has been livid really since last year, and the failure of, from I should say now 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, from 2011, the summer of 2011, that was a pivotal moment for Congress and for the Republicans in Congress, because that was the moment at which I think the public realized the lengths to which some members of Congress were going to try and extract spending cuts at every step of the stage. And it's not just on spending any bills anymore, but now they're playing a much more dangerous game around the debt ceiling.
And well, Heidi, I'm sorry, I hate to cut you off. We're going to continue the conversation about this dangerous game on the other side of this break. We're speaking to Heidi Prisbola from Bloomberg News, Professor Jerry Nicholsberg from UCLA. After the break, we'll continue our conversation on the fiscal cliff, and we'll talk to an expert on the art of negotiation to see what this latest congressional cage match can teach us. Stand by, please. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're talking about the continuing negotiations over America's so-called fiscal cliff with UCLA professor Jerry Nicholsberg and Heidi Prisbola, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. This whole fight over the fiscal cliff got us thinking about something Congress and some other major players have seemingly been unable to do successfully: negotiate. Lately, there have been a number of high-profile stalemates, not just in Congress, but between hospitals and California's nurses, ports and longshoremen, hockey players and team owners. Can these kinds of standoffs be avoided? And if so, how? Let's get some answers from Robert Mnookin. He's the chair of Harvard Law School's program on negotiation. He is also the author of the book Bargaining with the Devil, When to Negotiate and When to Fight. Professor Mnookin, welcome to Forum.
I'm delighted to be here.
What are your initial thoughts on the way that the fiscal cliff, quote-unquote, negotiations went down? What do you think of the whole process?
Well, I think we've just observed several weeks of some very hard bargaining. And I think what is most striking is that the negotiations are certainly going to continue. The deal that was made essentially relates to the revenue side, and it also extends, as you heard earlier, unemployment benefits for a number of people and did some other things. But basically, it's on the revenue side. And in fact, what we're now going to observe during the next couple months is another negotiation. This one is going to really relate to the expenditure side. And I think the thing to understand is, in terms of leverage, this second negotiation is going to be somewhat different than the first one.
Because the second will build on the first?
No, it's because in any negotiation, what you always have to ask is, what happens in terms of each party's perception if no deal is made?
What do you mean, each party's perception? The perception that other people have of them?
Let me be specific. The negotiation that just occurred, if no deal had been made, what was going to happen? Two things were going to happen. First, tax rates were going to go up substantially for everyone, including the middle class. And second, there was going to be expenditure cuts imposed 10% across the board. If you ask the question between the Republicans in the House on the one hand and the president on the other hand, who is hurt more by that happening? In this first round of negotiations, I think it was clear that President Obama really had the negotiation leverage. Why? Because if no deal was made, taxes were going to go up across the board, expenditures were going to be cut, and the Republicans would be in a position where the new Congress plainly was going to have to enact tax cuts. In other words, their alternative, if they didn't make a deal, was really bad. Indeed, you can read in the paper today how many Republicans are trying to reframe this initial deal as one in which, well, at least we've made permanent much of the Bush tax cuts.
You know, Professor Mnookin, pause on that for 1 second. Let me bring in Heidi Prisbola from Bloomberg News. And Heidi, let me get your perspective on exactly how congressional Republicans are putting forth their messaging today in the wake of this whole deal. Is it kind of damage control day or looking forward day? Or what's the early conversation sound like among congressional Republicans?
It was looking forward day as of last night. Basically, the Republicans had told me before they cut this deal, they knew they were going to have to compromise on taxes. And the strategy was really to call the president's bluff, if you will, in a way, using their words, that they would give him what he wanted, give him the tax increases, because in their mind, it was a losing battle, public relations. The public had said, large numbers of the American public had said they supported expiring those upper income tax rates, and if there was not a deal, the public also said they would blame Republicans. So on two fronts there, they were losing the battle. But now that they've given the president the revenue component, they are moving to very quickly, shift the discussion back to spending cuts, because they rightly make the point that this deal does not really do anything to solve our long-term debt problem. And now they have several deadlines that will help force this. This legislation, like we've discussed before, essentially creates three new cliffs. You've got the sequester, which now is going to expire. You have to also keep the government up up and running in the debt ceiling. And according to some of the experts I've been speaking with this morning, most likely what's going to happen here is you'll have one confluence, kind of one joining here, probably in late March, of all three of these deadlines, because the government can you know, put off the debt ceiling for 60 days, 30 to 60 days. And that it will all kind of culminate in one ungodly, you know, battle here again over spending cuts, where the Republicans will arguably have much more leverage than they did in negotiations over the fiscal cliff.
So instead of a fiscal cliff, we've got a fiscal peninsula, maybe. I don't know. I can't quite get the geography right.
I'll
but it becomes
you know what the new terminology is.
Yeah, I'm waiting. Soon. Whatever it is. It went from a cliff, from a slope to a cliff to, who knows, an archipelago. We'll see. But Professor Mnookin, let me put this question to you from the web. Dave writes, does anybody have any ideas on how to get a functional Congress? Gigantic question, but do you have any insights on if you could advise both sides, Professor Mnookin, on how to begin the negotiations this time around so that we don't end up basically at gunpoint at the end? How would you suggest they go about it this time?
I think that, in fact, there are a lot of shared interests. I think the president recognizes that in the long run, something has to be done about entitlements, especially Medicare. I think the Social Security problem, I think most recognize, is a solvable problem. It's an easier problem, but it too, in the long run, can be a problem. But I think both the administration and the Republicans recognize that. Second, I think there are probably some expenditure cuts in terms of the regular federal budget that can be reasonably made. Third, although last night the president indicated that he, too, recognizes there are going to have to be some constraints on spending, that he wants something done on the revenue side as well. And it's quite possible, by the way, that with tax reform, although it's going to be hard to do tax reform, you know, within a 90-day period, that with tax reform, there once again could be some shared interests. If the tax code could be simplified and rates even reduced a bit, if the corporate tax could be changed to get rid of some corporate tax loopholes, all of those things might be able to produce some revenue.
So then let me make sure we get this to a practical point. So because I want to make sure we answer the listener's question. With all that in mind, with the common ground in mind, and knowing that no one wants to let their political guard down and look like they're weak on the other side, practically, what would you suggest if you were in the room and could tell them how to conduct this negotiation with, you know, when you're bargaining, when you have to decide whether to negotiate or fight, as the title of your book says, how do you walk that line? What's the first thing you would suggest they say, do, enact, something practical?
Okay, the two things I would recommend is, first, there have to be discussions that can be private and not public, because there are stakeholders behind the table who, with any change in the tax code or any cut in expenditure, are going to scream and yell like crazy because they don't want the change. And unless conversations can be done with some degree of privacy, it's going to be very hard to explore the possible trade-offs. The second thing I would recommend is that, in fact, each side focus on their underlying long-run interests. And these interests, to some degree, do conflict. But on the other hand, there are a lot of shared interests.
We're speaking to Professor Robert Mnookin from Harvard Law School's Program on Negotiation. Also speaking to UCLA senior economist Jerry Nicholsberg and Heidi Prisbilla, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. We'd like to speak to you also. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786. You can also email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. Let's try to spend the rest of the hour taking as many of your calls and emails as possible, beginning with John in Lafayette. John, good morning.
Good morning to you.
What's on your mind, John?
You know, I've been listening to all of this, and there are substantial issues, obviously, around the economy and everything. But, you know, at the radix of it, what I think really is going on here is that the Republicans, and particularly Mitch McConnell, cannot stand the thought that a black man is in the White House, and that there is a sense of prejudice that they want to ruin. They're willing to ruin the country for the sake of ruining this president.
That has been kind of a hot topic for at least the last 4 years. I'm sure that'll be a hot topic for the remainder of his presidency. John, I appreciate your comment. Thank you very much. Let's go on to the next comment from Tim in Sacramento. Tim, good morning.
Hello. Speaking of Obama, I'd like to offer a point in his defense. I really don't think he caved on this. I think, you know, the budget was pretty ruthlessly held hostage by the far right, with the so-called proverbial Damocles sword held over the national and global economy. And for what it's worth, I would recommend a put on stock equity and money market exchanges for volatility in the near to midterm.
All right, Tim from Sacramento, thank you for your call. Let me go to an email question. Renee asks, does the federal fiscal deal affect the unemployment extensions in California? Professor Nicholsberg, I think perhaps you might be able to respond to this. Renee writes, it is my understanding that the deal would allow for federal extensions for unemployment to continue, and something like 923,000 Californians were in need of those. Jerry Nicholsberg from UCLA, do you have any insights on what this would mean for unemployment in California or for the employment picture in general in California?
Sure. As of January 1, the unemployment, extended unemployment benefits ended, and the deal that was just reached actually extends those and extends those for Californians. And, you know, in California, we have an unemployment rate that's about 2 percentage points higher than the rest of the U.S., so it's relatively more important for Californians who are on unemployment insurance to have that go through.
Let's take another phone call from Bill in Chicago. Bill, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Real quick question for the panel. I'm thinking more of losing a battle to win the war, and that would be for the Republican Party not to double down now on the debt ceiling, but instead allow the debt ceiling to be increased and not block any spending measures that come, so that the view in 2016 would be then they can control the debate on the economy by going, look, we gave the debt ceiling an increase. We allowed these spending increases. There was no effort on the Democratic Party to decrease spending. And look where it got us. Look at what the debt is now. So it's kind of losing this battle to win the war in 2016. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you much.
Great. Thank you, Bill. And thank you for calling from all the way in Chicago. Let me put that question to Professor Robert Mnookin from Harvard Law's Program on Negotiation. What do you make of that, allowing yourself to lose a battle for the sake of losing for the sake of winning the war?
I think that if we only had the Senate to deal with, that's a somewhat plausible argument. What was stunning in the last 2 days is that nearly 90% of the Republican senators voted for the bargain, for the deal. On the other hand, roughly two-thirds of the House Republicans voted against it. Now, a significant number did vote for it, and it carried easily. But nonetheless, two-thirds voted against it. That being the case, I think it is unlikely that the House Republicans will give up the leverage of the requirement that there be a debt ceiling increase in order to keep the federal government running. Turns out that nearly 40 cents of every dollar the federal government's spending now has to be financed through debt. And the current debt ceiling, as was indicated earlier, is probably, we don't know precisely, but in February or March, that ceiling is going to be reached. And that means that if nothing happens, if Congress doesn't enact anything, the federal government's going to run out of money and have to stop spending, and we're going to risk having our credit, at least in the short run, substantially jeopardized. That puts lots of pressure, I think, on the president to make some kind of deal. But, of course, also puts pressure on Congress, and they'll be trying to once again frame things to play the blame game so that the other side is blamed more. Mm-hmm. But in response to your caller's question, I don't think the House Republicans are in any mood to give up the leverage to constrain expenditures and address entitlements by simply rolling over.
We're going to take more of your calls and emails. I should get to some of the emails to those of you who've been writing in at forum@kqed.org. Please feel free to keep calling 866-733-6786. We'll get to as many of you as we can before the hour is up. Ron writes, isn't part of the deficit problem that the Bush-era tax cuts have created our structural debt, with the result that the wealthy have effectively saved billions at the same time that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan went unpaid for the last 10 years? I know it's not on the political agenda, but isn't part of our problem for the debt, not the deficit, the debt, to claw back these unsustainable tax cuts from the last 10 years? Now, by making the Bush cuts more or less permanent, we have baked in a huge deficit for the future. Mark writes, I supported the president in the election and in his desire to raise taxes on the wealthy, but I don't support the extension of unemployment benefits. If it's been over a year and you can't find work, then you need to move or do something radical to change things up. Susan writes, NPR and most newscasters keep saying Congress is dysfunctional and use generalizations that include everyone in Congress. I agree, but let's focus on those who are the problems, the hardcore conservative Republicans. They should be held accountable for the problems we have. The Democrats need to go further, but always pull back to settle. Let's go to another call from Greg in Petaluma. Greg, good morning.
Hi, Joshua. Thank you. To that last email, I'm just so curious about who the Republican House members are truly representing. I mean, are they representing their constituents, and are their constituents as rabidly right-wing as they are, or are they simply representing their big moneyed interests, which, you know, they seem to be portrayed as representing?
Thanks for the question, Greg. Heidi Prisbola from Bloomberg News, what do you make of that?
You know, the one thing that happened in this last election that I think was confusing for a lot of Americans is that Democrats took the Senate and Republicans took the House, and the Republicans made the argument that therefore we have a mandate. But you have to remember that a lot of these members are representing their base, because what happened in this last election was one of the biggest redistrictings that we've had on behalf of Republicans since, really, Republicans haven't controlled this many state legislatures since the 1930s, okay? And so a lot of these districts that were once swing districts, like in Pennsylvania and Ohio, were rewritten in order to give a lot of these Republican members much safer districts. So they rearrange the districts to have more conservative support there. So they really are, in some ways, they view it as representing the interests of their members. Of course, there's a lot of cynicism that comes with that, that
right,
these members are, in fact, also being, you know, handmaidens of big business, and that what we need is a radical reform of our campaign finance laws. And I'd be the first person to say that that is a very serious ill in our political system as well. But you can't discount also the importance of redistricting. And going forward, we're going to have more conservatives in the House and more liberals, however you want to define that word, in the Senate going forward, if you kind of want to look at the prognosis for compromise in the next Congress.
866-733-6786. Let's speak to Pat in Cloverdale. Pat, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This sort of goes along with a little bit what the last person was talking about. But I think that if members of Congress, if their work week was more than 3 days a week, which I think it is now, and then they go home to their constituents and their families, if their families moved to Washington like they used to, and they actually lived in Washington and socialized with each other and went out to dinner with each other, and their kids went to the same schools and they went to sporting events with their kids, and they kind of got to know each other outside of the legislation, and perhaps they could talk without, you know, and listen to each other more. I have to think that would help. It sounds simplistic, but I don't know how that can be encouraged. But
No, I don't,
I don't think
it sounds
help.
Too simplistic, Pat. I mean, I think that's one of the things that certainly in the last few days in terms of the relationship between Senator Mitch McConnell and now Vice President Joe Biden that helped to make the deal happen was that they knew each other from the Senate for so long and they'd had 30 years experience together and they were able to just sit down and talk like human beings rather than having to fight it out constantly. Pat, thanks for that call. Let's go now to Nick in San Rafael. Nick, good morning.
Hi. My question sort of addresses what you said earlier before all the calls. You were questioning what would fix the political gridlock. May seem kind of obvious, but I'm thinking, what if nobody could hold a majority in the House or the Senate because of, you know, third parties? If there are enough third parties elected in the Congress, and that would be my question.
So more of an independent party system. All right, that's a possibility. Thank you, Nick. Let me go to another email. Judith, by the way, our email address, forum@kqed.org. Judith writes, how did we go from jobs to the deficit becoming the major problem? My interpretation is that unemployment is the most pressing issue. If more people are working, there will be more customers for the private sector to use some of their billions to hire more workers and more tax revenues to pay down the deficit. Let me put this to you, Professor Nicholsberg from UCLA. That's one of the things I also recall reading in the latest Anderson report, again, about all these different levers that pull kind of in tension and balance with each other, about the nature of high-income earners having more taxes and that affects spending, or employment that puts more revenue into the markets. Talk about where that balance sits right now for California in terms of our economy moving forward. The jobs picture, the revenue picture, how tenuous is that balance right now?
Well, it's a very complex equation. So in California, we, with Prop 30, raised our income tax rates on the highest income earners to the highest in the nation. And so you add those to the new rates that were just passed with this deal, and you have over 50% of income earned by high-income earners in California is paid out in taxes. Well, is that the tipping point where you have new job creation occurring elsewhere because the tax burden is too high? Remains to be seen. In the past, increases in taxes on high-income earners have had a marginal effect, but not a huge effect because of the benefits both of living in California and the very dynamic knowledge communities that we have here. But that advantage may be dissipating, particularly if the problems continue and the high tax rates continue relative to elsewhere for a long period of time.
Right.
Now, since the recovery began, California, particularly along the coast, has been growing faster than the U.S., and we've had faster job creation than the U.S., even up until the last 12 months, so that, although that's slowing. The interaction of the fiscal cliff and the impending new fiscal cliff and the higher tax rates, fairly complicated. It's hard to say what that's going to do, except it is going to slow job creation and economic growth in California.
Let's go to another phone call from Greg in Indianapolis, Indiana. Greg, hello.
Hello. Well, I'm not a fan of any Republican or Democrat, just to say that first, but to lump all the Republicans together, but I had heard that a lot of the gridlock last year was caused by just a few Tea Party members. So in the art of negotiation, how does the president and Boehner deal with those few really radical right-wing members that caused most of the gridlock?
It's a good question. Let's put that to Professor Robert Mnookin. Professor, how do you deal with a faction within the Republican Party that seems to be forcing the Republican Party to negotiate differently than it would otherwise?
Well, with difficulty. And in fact, I'm not sure it's just a few. I mean, recall that yesterday, as I said, basically two-thirds of the Republicans in the House voted against this deal. So that's not a small fraction. As I indicated, though, 90% of the senators who are Republican voted for it. I think part of the difficulty has been, of course, that Speaker Boehner has had real problems behind the table. although at one level, this looks like it's a negotiation between one or more congressional leaders and the president. In fact, it's a much more complicated negotiation because behind the table on each side, there are deep internal conflicts. Now, on the Democratic side, the conflicts seem much less substantial, although there were some Democrats grousing about the deal that was made with respect to taxes, that it wasn't good enough, that the president should have held the 250. Overwhelming majority went in favor. On the Republican side, though, in the House, that wasn't the case. And I think part of the challenge is going to be how the House Republicans, the Republicans in the Senate on the one hand, and the significant minority of reasonable Republicans in the House on the other hand, can persuade some of the Tea Party folks to be somewhat more flexible. Now, I'm guardedly optimistic, although there's going to be a lot of wrangling, and I think we're going to go right up to the cliff once again in February and March. I think, in fact, once again, a deal is going to be made. Something will be done with Medicare. Something will be done, you know, with expenditures, and a bargain will eventually be reached. But it's going to be messy, and it's, of course, possible that once again we'll have a real crisis, and it could have a very adverse effect on our economy. I mean, for the United States to go into default would be a disaster.
Indeed it would. Speaking of the cliff, we're about to fall over the edge of this hour for our conversation about the fiscal cliff. Heidi Prisbola from Bloomberg News, last few seconds, any insights, any observations about the mood of Congress right now as they prepare for this next fight? Very, very briefly, please.
Very briefly, the Republicans are licking their wounds. The Democrats are already in, you know, defensive posture, saying, don't even think about it, picking a fight over the debt ceiling. You know, we're not going to go there. But, of course, everybody knows that's exactly what the Republicans plan to do, because they feel like, you know, to quote your previous viewer, they sacrificed this battle in order to, you know, win a larger principled war. They're going to go for those spending cuts.
We'll definitely see how it shakes out. That's Heidi Prisbola, congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. Heidi, I appreciate the insights. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Professor Jerry Nicholsberg, economics professor from UCLA's Anderson School of Management and the senior economist for the UCLA Anderson Forecast. Professor, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Professor Robert Mnuchin of Harvard Law School's Program on Negotiation. Thanks for the insights, Professor. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
In our next hour, we'll take on warrantless wiretapping, a bill that passed Congress somewhat under the radar of all of this debate over the fiscal cliff. FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, is our topic for the hour to come. Stay with us, please. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.